Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Everyone, from the president to vulnerable freshman members of Congress, are expected to try to spin the issues to their advantage. Joining us on the line is Boston Globe political reporter Rick Klein. And Rick, one Republican strategist told the Washington Post yesterday that the Democrats have a 9 in 10 chance of taking back the House, while a Newsweek poll says 50% of Americans said they'd vote for a Democrat in congressional elections if they were held today. Only 38 responded they'd vote Republican. So what changed?
Well, I think the hints of voter anger over the Iraq War, over gas prices, over the sluggish economy, even going back to Katrina and Social Security privatization last year has impacted President Bush. I think all of those things have come together for an anti-incumbent wave. And really the question is, no one really knows how big that wave is going to be, whether it's going to be something that the Republicans can withstand and hold on to their 15-seat margin advantage in the House and 6-seat margin in the Senate, or if it's something that's going to be significant enough to actually put the Democrats back into the power for the first time in 12 years.
You mentioned the Senate. Is there a chance that the Democrats might also take the Senate? As we said, pundits are, you know, already placing bets on the House, but what about the Senate?
Yeah, I mean, I think if a pundit were to put it at 9 in 10 chance for the House, I think they'd probably rank it at 1 in 10 in the Senate. Doable, but a long shot at this point. Everything really has to go right just because of the seats that are in play this year and the ones that aren't, because only one-third of the senators are up for re-election every 2 years. The fact that all House members, all 435 House members, are on the ballot means that the national wave really can impact a House election in just one election cycle.
So there will be a scramble on the campaign trail, and Democrats are already saying, well, you know, we don't really care about that analysis because Republicans have more money to spend. But will we also see a correlating scramble in Congress to get some legislation passed if, in fact, there's a whiff that there might be a change in congressional leadership in the midterm elections?
Yeah, there's about a month left in the congressional session before they all break before the election. There's going to be a big focus on national security issues, on some war authorization, some Defense Department authorization bills, and authorizing the wireless, the warrantless wiretapping that President Bush has allowed in the past. And those will allow these kind of issues to be on big display. Republicans think that's an advantage. But Democrats have been fighting back pretty aggressively. They're looking for a no-confidence vote on Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld. And they're very, very aggressive in pushing back on any Republicans who say that Democrats would make the world less safe. And what they're saying is actually it's been President Bush's policies that have left America more vulnerable to attack.
I want to talk about that no-confidence vote. Democrats are going to be pressing for a no-confidence in Donald Rumsfeld vote this month. He, of course, received widespread condemnation in newspaper editorials and elsewhere last week for likening people who criticized the war to Nazi appeasers. Frank Rich pointing out in his column in The Times yesterday that it was Rumsfeld who was famously photographed about a decade ago warmly shaking hands with Saddam Hussein. As Rich says, you know, talk about appeasement. So what do you think, Rick Klein? Will Rumsfeld survive the call for him to step down? And if he does, will that picture and his comments hurt the Republicans during this campaign?
Well, what's interesting here is I think both sides see it in very different ways. I think Republicans continue to see Rumsfeld and the policies that he's championed as a major selling point. And to the extent that people are ready to link the war on terror with the war in Iraq, they may be right. But to the extent that people see them as very separate things, and I see the war in Iraq as a mistake, as a continuing problem, obviously, in terms of America's image and in terms of casualties and money spent, then Secretary Rumsfeld's continued presence could be harmful. I can't foresee a shakeup this late in the election cycle. Like, President Bush has made clear that Rumsfeld is his guy. There's been pressure from both sides to push him out, but the president has been pretty strong on this, and I think this close to election, 2 months out, for him to shake up the leadership of the Defense Department would be pretty unlikely.
Well, as you said, that photograph was from a long time ago when Rumsfeld was a citizen sent to sort of woo Iraq during the Iraq-Iran war. But some are saying that people who make campaign ads are already scrambling to try to find it. So campaign ads are about to really hit us, are they not?
Oh, yeah, and I think this, you know, calling this next cycle unusually negative, I think that happens whenever there's a chance of one party or the other taking over, is you'll see a lot more aggression on both sides in the campaign. And these last 2 months will certainly be pretty strong, more money than ever being spent on these races and a lot at stake.
Boston Globe political reporter Rick Klein. Rick, happy Labor Day to you.
Thanks. Same to you.
Thanks for working with us.
Do you have a card or something I can get in touch with you? I run a small sawmill, and I reclaim woods coming down from developments, and I utilize the wood chips. I'm working on making methanol.
Earlier this summer, over 500 local entrepreneurs exchanged business cards and ideas at the 4th Annual Bally Conference held in Burlington, Vermont. Bally stands for Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, a national organization with chapters dedicated to supporting locally owned businesses through Buy Local First campaigns. One of the most successful is in Bellingham, Washington. It's headed by Bally board member Michelle Long.
Our coupon book associated with the campaign is the best-selling book at our local bookstore. A few years ago, locally owned was not really at the front of anybody's mind. Just a few years later, business owners are saying, people are calling them, saying, are you guys locally owned? You are? Well, then we want to come in.
As they do every year, conference attendees took a field trip in Burlington. They visited the Intervale, a nonprofit farming cooperative founded by the catalog company Garden Supply. The Intervale supplies 6% of Burlington's food, largely to public institutions.
People feel a sense of ownership. You know, that's our strawberry farm. Oh, yeah, we come here every week. This is our farm stand.
Back at one of dozens of breakout sessions at the conference, Bally members share tactics for getting state governments to buy more local products for public institutions such as colleges and hospitals. And they answer questions from entrepreneurs struggling to stay afloat.
My name is Monica Farrell. I work with Cooperative Coffees. We're a co-op of 21 small-scale and medium-scale coffee roasters, all fair trade and organic. And what we're seeing now is this sort of corporatization of the concept of fair trade and organic. How do you confront these big companies when they come in and appropriate your identity?
Did anyone else think it was surreal when McDonald's started selling organic coffee? So, you know, and you can go both ways. You can say, wow, that's amazing. That's what this is all about, right? Getting them to behave. Or, holy crap, they stole our thing. What is good about local is relatively unassailable. Someone might come on the air and say, we're your local McDonald's. People are not stupid. They know authenticity. If you can take the message from the local movement, it's about authentic experiences with people that you connect to.
Communities and businesses of the world unite. You have nothing to lose but your chains.
Guest speakers made arguments that locally owned businesses maintain community character and keep more dollars circulating locally than chain stores do. But Bill McKibben, author of End of Nature, also added that towns with healthy local economies will be the only ones to survive future fuel shortages and global warming. We decided to ask him more. Local economies and global warming?
We've got to figure out how to stop using so much fossil fuel. And one of the reasons we use so much is because we move everything that we eat and buy and whatever enormous distances. The average bite of food in this country travels 2,000 miles before it reaches your lips. We basically order takeout every night of the year from the farthest corners of the planet. And the energy cost of doing that is intense. The same with everything else we buy and use, but food is the most obvious and easy to change because it was only 75 years ago that everybody ate locally. So if you're shopping at a farmer's market, you're using something like 10 times less energy than if you're shopping at the supermarket.
You had a slew of statistics, studies that you cited. One had to do with farmers markets as opposed to supermarkets, people trailing people around both. What were the findings?
Well, this was really interesting. Academics, some researchers followed shoppers in the supermarket. They just put down their eyes to the cart, got out of there as fast as they could, maybe talked about paper or plastic at the checkout. When they followed people around the farmer's market, they found them having 10 times more conversations than people at the supermarket, building 10 times more community.
You painted a pretty dire picture. Do you really see communities becoming self-sustaining and, you know, providing almost everything they need?
I don't think we need to go in the direction of doing everything that we need. I think what we need is to change the trajectory away from the ever bigger, ever more global, ever more Walmartized, back in the direction of getting smaller, more local. You know, we're never going to go back to having 50% of Americans farming. But at the moment, we have 1% of Americans farming. There are way more prisoners in this country than there are farmers.
You cited a statistic that after World War II, Americans have more, or humans have...
Humans have used more natural resources in the years since World War II than in all of human history before. We're using up the world at a rate that we just can't sustain. something that becomes particularly apparent now that the Chinese and the Indians have decided, hey, what do you know, they'd kind of like to get on this game too. Here's the reason that we can't go on with the sort of model that we're using right at the moment. If our idea is that all the world is somehow going to be like us, that would mean China alone, there'd be 850 million cars. If the Chinese ate meat in the way that we do, it would require two-thirds of the world's grain harvest just to provide China alone with its dinner.
How do you control how successful a local business and economy gets so that it stays local? I'm thinking of Ben Cohen and Tom's of Maine, and you're laughing.
It's a very difficult problem, and I don't know the answer to it exactly. I think that we're going to have to evolve regulations that don't do away with markets, because markets seem to work, but that put real limits on the demand that local institutions, schools, and hospitals buy a large percentage of their food locally. Things like that will tend to try to keep things more rather than less localized. And I think more than anything else, more than the sets of laws and regulations that we evolve, what we really need to evolve is some gut, visceral understanding that we need to be in an economy that involves our neighbors. That's not a liberal idea. That's not a conservative idea. That's a neighborly idea.
You had a stat about how many Americans know their neighbors.
Something like 3/4 of Americans don't know their next-door neighbor. They may know their name or who they are, but they don't have a relationship with them. I mean, there's never been any human being or probably any other primate that lived in that way. We've got to get over that. What fossil fuel has allowed us to, cheap fossil fuel, is develop a kind of hyper-individualism that isn't serving us and that isn't serving the planet. There are business models evolving. Like, for instance, there's an entrepreneur in this state at the Farmer's Diner who's been envisioning sort of locally based franchised idea of local food all around the country with different pool of investors in each state who would do it. But, you know, personally, I've tried to do most of my buying from people who grow things and who make things. One of my only, sort of rules for personal conduct is never eat in a restaurant of which there's more than one. Because, A, you might eat something interesting, and, B, you know you're helping someone whose life is there.
Your dollar stays in the community.
That's it.
Bill McKibben, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
That's Bill McKibben, author of End of Nature. We spoke with him at this summer's Business Alliance for Local Living Economies Conference in Burlington, Vermont. Well, when we come back, we'll hear from Michael Schumann, author of Small Mart. He does have answers to those questions about what happens when local businesses get too big. He also says towns have to plug up their leaks, find places where they could be buying locally, but they aren't, leaking dollars to outside companies. Stay with us. Much more coming up this Labor Day, here and now. Improve my town's economy?
To look at the economy of Montana is to see a disaster area. In my community, it was how do we get BMW to build their plant,
right,
and how much money do we have to pay them, instead of supporting local businesses.
Right. Well, that's one of the things I talk about in the first chapter. I debated about...
Michael Schumann's argument is that local businesses are competitive with the multinationals, and in the long run, better investments for communities. So we invited him to our studios to ask, how can that be? For instance, Michael, cost. As you know, one of your critics, Professor Hart Hargis of Western Washington University, studied tennis balls, and he found that those that he bought at chains were a fraction of the cost of the ones he found at local stores.
The rallying cry we use is local first. There are some instances, and tennis balls might be one of them, where you can get a cheaper deal at a chain store, and by all means, go ahead and spend that money. But what we ask people to do is to think very carefully about each and every expenditure. For example, on pharmaceutical drugs, there's a study every year in Maine which shows that the cheapest drugs, and this would surprise people, comes not from the chains and not from Walmart, but from the local pharmacies. The Walmarts, the Targets, they do have a bunch of loss leaders, so some items are very cheap. But most of the items on sale at those chain stores, in fact, are pretty competitive with what you can get locally.
But you say that laws and regulations are foolishly tilted towards chains and big companies. For instance, if someone wants to support a local store through more than just a purchase, let's say they want to invest in one, they're prohibited by current security laws.
I'll give you an example. You can walk into any casino in the country and lose your shirt. And yet, if I was to put a single dollar into a local small business that hadn't gone through, say, $50,000 to $100,000 of legal filings, both myself and the small business I was investing in could be hauled off to jail. Securities laws need to create broader exemptions for small business. The next step is to create a trading system, basically a little NASDAQ, in each and every state, maybe even in each and every community, so we can get what economists call liquidity in stock.
I heard you talking about this at the Bally Conference, and you were saying that, for instance, in Maine, if there had been a local or a statewide stock exchange, there might have been that liquidity when Toms of Maine had to sell.
Absolutely. I mean, what we are saying is that if we can create a market where there are many people prepared to invest locally within a state, the next time a Toms of Maine decides to sell itself out to a non-Maine potential investor, we stand ready to actually match or beat the offer and keep that asset within the state.
There are other incentives that states give to companies that are not local. The thinking is on the part of most state lawmakers, if we can just bring in that big company, think of all the jobs they'd provide. So why?
Well, absolutely. And what they forget is that, in fact, those jobs are much less reliable than jobs that come from local business.
What do you mean by reliable? They don't stay?
That's right. I debated a fellow in Oregon named Jack Roberts. Jack doled out, over a period of about 6 years, millions and millions of dollars of tax abatements. And basically, 95% went to six large outside-owned companies. Three came, took the benefits, and left. Two came, took the benefits, and never provided the jobs they promised. One was sort of on target. The other 5% of the tax abatements went to literally 100 local businesses that all pretty much delivered the modest promises they made. The bottom line was that a job from a local business cost about 1/15 of what a job from a big behemoth cost.
Give us some examples of how states have, well, here in Massachusetts we have one. Massachusetts just spent $33 million in tax credits, $34 million in state spending to infrastructure to bring in 550 potential jobs from Bristol Myers Squibb Company.
The total expenditure each year by state and local governments in order to either fetch a new source of jobs from outside the state or to retain an existing business is $50 billion. The examples really go into the stratosphere. Jeb Bush spent about $1 million per job in order to lure the Scripps Medical and Oceanographic Facility into Florida. At about $350,000, $400,000 per job, you could take that same money, put it into a low-interest bond, and basically pay a family of four a living wage in perpetuity without ever needing the corporation at all.
Well, these are some of the much larger issues. But what, you know, let's say someone's ears have perked up and they say, you know what, I want to help strengthen my local economy. I want to do more than just purchasing things locally. What do I do?
I think the first thing is to demand that your city government start doing economic planning as if the local business community mattered. I've been working in both upstate New York and in Maine to help communities there actually identify leakages in their economy. And what I mean by leakages are, where are there places where you are buying goods and services from outside the economy you could, in principle, produce locally cost-effectively? One example would be in St. Lawrence County. We did an analysis of the asset base of that county and found they had 250,000 acres of abandoned farmland, about $5 billion of investable capital, and several thousand people unemployed. And I was looking, for example, at meat leakages. In this dairy county, they are importing several thousand cows each year. But the most amazing thing is they are importing 2 million chickens. Think about how you could use that farmland and the unemployed individuals and that investable capital and create a local chicken business that makes you self-reliant on poultry.
You talk about other ways to do that. For instance, making a public policy that public institutions purchase locally.
Absolutely.
Hospitals, schools.
Yes. The total level of state and local contracts right now is about $2 trillion. So one gets a sense that if you can just get a few percentage points more of that going to local business, it can make an enormous difference in your economy.
Michael Schumann's book is The Small Mart Revolution, How Local Businesses Are Beating the Global Competition. He's also a member of BALI, Business Alliance for Local Living Economies. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us this Labor Day. More ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, the Museum of Science, Boston, and the National Academy of Engineering, promoting engineering and technological literacy in grades K-12 nationwide, mos.org/NCTL. And The Economist, the weekly global magazine, with commentary and analysis on world politics, business, finance.
Now, several strikes and bloody labor battles later, National Geographic Books has published a big book about work through the ages and around the world. It's called Work, the World in Photographs, and it features the work of 80 photographers, including Steve McCurry. He's probably best known for his haunting photograph of a young green-eyed Afghan girl, which appeared on the cover of National Geographic magazine years ago. Well, another McCurry photo from Asia is on this new book's cover. It's from Sri Lanka. It shows stilt fishermen perched on bamboo poles coming out of the water. And Steve McCurry joins us on the line from his home in New York. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you very much.
You know, a lot of the pictures that you took are in Asia, and it strikes us, especially thinking of those fishermen, you know, plopped on those poles out in the middle of the ocean, that even though this area is so high-tech, the workers, at least in some of the pictures, seem to be stuck in a time warp. What was your sense?
Well, in Asia, one of the things that's so great about working in Asia is that people often do things in a manual way by hand. And they do things in an ancient sort of way, which we've kind of lost. And to kind of go there and see how they do things is sort of a glimpse back into the way life must have been in the United States or in Europe. So in a way, it's sort of stepping back in time. And I find that, you know, really fascinating to see the way our ancestors must have lived at one time.
Well, there's another photograph that's jumping out at me. It's on page 108. Those following along, and it's an image of a young child. She's begging on the street in Hardwar, India, and she looks beautiful. I mean, her finery. Can you describe that picture for us?
There are these very interesting festivals in India, and people come from far and wide, and this is an opportunity to make a little bit of money. So this family has actually dressed up their child as a Hindu deity, which in this case it's Shiva. So this little boy's...
Oh, it's a boy.
Mm-hmm. It's a boy, yeah. His body's been covered in blue. They've been, you know, adorned him with ornaments and makeup and all that. And he's there to collect money so people to show their appreciation or their devotion to Shiva will give this young boy a few coins. And that boy stood there literally all day from early morning into night for 3 days in a row. And I don't know how much he made, but that was I had a lot of respect for that child. It was all that work, just standing there in that position.
Yeah, he's posed. He's got one hand out to the right with his fingers tight against, you know, his hand. And in the other hand, in his left hand, he's holding sort of a drum, a symbolic couple of little drums, like Shiva. And I'm just wondering, though, you know, you come across people in dire straits all the time as a photographer. Just a quick thought. Did you give him money?
I think it's not. I think as far as giving people money, in this case, I think it was absolutely the right thing to do. I mean, here I'm photographing the child, maybe taking some of the child's time. And I think to donate a few coins, I think, would be really mean-spirited. So I think in some cases, it's the right thing, the honorable thing, the ethical thing to do, to actually help some of these people out, because they're in a very desperate way, in a very desperate situation. And I think any opportunity to help these people, that they're most appreciative.
It's something that photographers wrestle with. That when you take someone's image, what do you owe them? But staying with that picture, it's in contrast to another one in the book. Now the book is a coffee table, beautiful book. It's split into sections according to different regions. For the Americas segment, the first picture is a photograph taken by photographer Jody Cobb. It features a mother and her young daughter. It's you see them from behind. The young daughter is preparing for a beauty pageant, and it seems especially chilling in light of all the news recently about the JonBenet Ramsey murder case here in the U.S. This picture is from Georgia, I think. The tiny little tot has a huge head of teased out blonde hair, a little pageant dress on. What does that picture symbolize? Is that work?
I think that child labor is a bit of a problem, especially in the third world. Parents often will force their children to work in restaurants, when I was in Afghanistan last week, I had a 12-year-old boy change the oil in our Jeep. Mm. Often when you're in a place like India or Afghanistan, the people who bring your food or clear your dishes are young children. They should be in school, yet they're forced into work because the family is extremely poor. So child labor is really very present in vast parts of the world.
Well, speaking of children, and speaking to Steve McCurry, photographer for National Geographic, the new book is Work, The World in Photographs, the work of Steve and other photographers. But, of course, you know, I'm sure the one photo that people still ask you about is the one you took years ago of the iconic photo of the green-eyed girl in Afghanistan. And then you went back and found her grown up to be a woman, who'd lived quite a hard life in Afghanistan, and it showed on her face, you know, that woman, Sharbat Gula. Do you have a relationship with her now? Or, I mean, do you plan to go back and, photograph her again? I mean, how does that work for a photographer?
Well, we actually had been looking for her for some years, and in 2002 we got lucky, and against all odds we were actually able to find her, which was like a miracle. But once we found her, National Geographic did absolutely the right thing by helping her in many significant ways, and actually have given back to her for use of the picture. And helped not only her, but her family and her brother and whatnot. So it's actually been a win-win situation for everybody, for her, for National Geographic, for myself. And I can say that, yeah, we're still in touch with her, and her life has really improved dramatically with the assistance that the Geographic has given her.
Steve McCurry, photographer for National Geographic. The new book his work is featured in is called Work, The World in Photographs. And you can see some of the pictures at our website, here-now.org. Steve, thanks as always for telling us about it.
Thank you for having me.
And a quick note still to come today, a new book and a CD on under-the-radar cooking. For instance, do you know how many people use the George Foreman grill to survive, really? Well, this all comes from NPR's The Kitchen Sisters. They're up in a little while. You're listening to Here and Now. Time for a little vocabulary quiz. You know how we love words. So define these: Easter egg and cocktail. Easy, right? Well, you might be surprised by some of the new definitions for these common words. And then there's dark matter or cosmeceutical. These are less common, but now you can look them up. The American Heritage Dictionary has a new edition out, and executive editor Joseph Pickett is here to tell us more about these newly defined and redefined words. Joseph, welcome.
Thank you.
Cosmeceutical, I was guessing prescription drugs in outer space.
But I was wrong. It sounds like that, cosmic pharmaceutical, but it's actually cosmetic pharmaceutical. That's the blend. So it's a cosmetic that has or is purported to have pharmacological benefits.
We understand over 10,000 new words and senses were added this year. And you can tell because I've got this big volume here. What's a sense?
Oh, it's another definition for a word. So one of the things that we just added, for example, is a new sense of cheat, the noun cheat, which is a password that you click into a video game to move up to a higher level without actually accomplishing that through the game. My son has definitely gotten a lot of cheats in his career as a video gamer.
And now he's gotten a word into his dad's big old dictionary.
Yeah.
What's the new sense of Easter egg?
Ah, that's a hidden feature in computer software, a DVD, or a video game. So it's a kind of something you have to go and find, like an Easter egg. That's the metaphor.
Ah, and I'm guessing new sense of cocktail would be, for instance, an AIDS cocktail?
Right, yeah, a combination of drugs taken at the same time.
Dark matter. This is another word that was recently added, or phrase that was recently added to the American Heritage Dictionary.
Well, that's the matter in the universe that is supposed to be there but can't be detected. And it's supposed to be there because otherwise the universe would fly apart.
How do you make these decisions? Do you vote on it?
Yeah, well, it is a judgment, and it's a judgment on the part of, well, me and other people on the staff. And usually we have people on the staff who specialize in certain areas of vocabulary. So they familiarize themselves with what's in our dictionary, and then they start looking at the vocabulary, the emerging vocabulary in that area.
So, for instance, if someone was specializing in food, they'd let you know that fattoush was being widely used.
Yes, absolutely. That's a tough call there, though, because as soon as you walk into any ethnic restaurant, you have a whole list of words there that are readily available to go in a dictionary, and you have to be careful because we can't enter all of them.
Fattoush is a salad made from moistened toasted bread, cucumbers, tomatoes, mint, and other ingredients. It's delicious.
Yes. And I mean, that's an interesting area, too, because in foods, that's one area where English is borrowing words directly from other languages at a high rate.
We also understand that the dictionary has regional notes. What are these?
Well, we have about, I think, 500 regional terms, terms that are used most commonly in one region or another of the United States. Huh. And the regional notes are really a lot of fun. You know, they give you all the words of dragonfly, like ear sower and snake doctor, and explain where they come from.
Oh, so that's how dragonfly is used across the country.
Yeah, I think skeeter hawk is another one. They give our language a lot of its variation and poetry, really, I think.
There's also full-color pictures. There's a picture of Kermit the Frog at Macy's Parade, and that's for the word inflatable.
Yeah.
What are some others that you liked?
Planetary nebula. That's a beautiful colored image, I think, taken by the Hubble Space Telescope.
Well, Joseph Pickett, what are some of your other favorites of the new words that have been added?
Some words from science I like a lot. Rentgenium, that's a new element named after the man who discovered X-rays, I think, and that's used to be called element number 111.
It's going to be a great Scrabble word, R-O-E-N-T-G-E-N-I-U-M. And one of my favorites, shout-out, a public expression of gratitude or recognition. But, you know, the purists would say, shout-out. That's slang. That doesn't belong in a real dictionary. What do you say?
People are always looking for new ways of saying things. Say, especially young people, they're looking for ways of expressing themselves that they feel are their own. Older people can act like fuddy-duddies and tell them not to do it, but that's an exercise in futility, I think, because they did it too when they were young, and that's just the nature of language. So I would say that welcome, shout-out, and many more after it.
Joseph Pickett, the executive editor for the 2006 American Heritage Dictionary. Joseph, thanks so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Stay with us. The Kitchen Sisters are ahead here and now. Thank you.
they get calls.
I'm calling about a Friday night fish fry that's in my local community in Lake Waccamaw.
If you're looking for the ultimate hidden kitchen, it is our Meals on Wheels kitchen. You can't see it from the main street. There's no sign.
I work as a contract cook for science expedition trips on the Colorado River in Grand Canyon.
Message 15.
The cooking club is often the only chance that the ladies of Skid Row get to eat fresh food.
My family has a hidden kitchen in our barn near our house, and we used to cook our turkey in a trash can. So the men in the family, it's been a good chance to talk.
More than 2,000 listeners called with stories of cooking communities in truck stops, cab stands, steamships, prison cells, Indian reservations, NASCAR pits, disappearing food traditions, the power of food as community glue. Hundreds of these stories are collected in Hidden Kitchens, a new book, and also a CD of clips narrated by Frances McDormand that sold separately. And the Kitchen Sisters join us now from Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. We have Nikki Silva.
Hi.
And Davia Nelson. Hi, Davia.
Ahoy.
Ahoy. Well, yes, I mentioned you were on boats as well. What inspired this search for the Hidden Kitchen?
I live in San Francisco. This is Davia. I started noticing that every time I got into a yellow cab, the driver was from Brazil, and not just from Brazil, but the same town in Brazil, Goiânia. Anyway, the drivers over the months started telling me about a woman who every night at sundown would come and set up a makeshift rolling night kitchen. They just said, you know, you've got to come down and check it out. So one night we got our gear and we snuck through the cab yard and out the other side. And there was this woman, Jeanette, out in the middle of nowhere with this little, under a street light and a little blue tarp. And we say it was our first hidden kitchen vision. Yeah. And it opened our eyes up.
And there were so many others. Nikki, a lot of the calls that you got on the hotline that you set up were tips from people pointing out other largely ethnic kitchens that they noticed.
Oh, so many calls, and it was just wonderful to listen to them all. They told us about things that we never would have come up on our own. We got this one message from a woman who said that to her, the most hidden kitchen was the George Foreman Grill.
Immigrants and low-income people, the people who struggle to even get food on the table because they don't have an official kitchen and who are using George Foreman grills and the like.
You talked to some of these near homeless people for whom the grill was practically their whole kitchen. You also talked to George Foreman.
He was amazed, and it triggered something in him. He began talking immediately about his own story of hunger.
My lean, mean, fat-reducing grilling machine.
I grew up in Houston, Texas, in the Fifth Ward area. Every day at lunch during the summer days, you hear the parents call the kids in. They would just tell me, okay, go home and eat your lunch. And these people knew I had no food at home. And I'd peep through the window at the kids eating, and the parents would peel the crust off the bread. And I would sit there and just hope they would just throw it out the window for me.
Some of the calls are so emotional. I'm thinking of the soldier who called about food that was sent to him while he was out in the battlefield. And that box of food, that was his kitchen.
One of the calls also to the line was from a man who had received a sort of wayward pineapple upside down cake that was meant for another soldier. And it had gone so far astray in Vietnam that he and his buddies decided to eat it, but he wrote back to the parents of the soldier who had sent it.
Anyhow, I wrote to them and told them the situation and thanked them, and that I'd never got anything in the mail and all that kind of stuff. And they, in about 2 weeks, they sent me a tin of homemade chocolate chip cookies, and they were delicious. I kept their address for a long time, and I lost it, but they were from Connecticut. And if I still knew how to get in touch with them, I would.
By the way, did he ever find them?
You know, I don't think he did. It's funny, when that call went out on NPR and we played that, we got so many people wanting to engage in the search for this family with him. It was so interesting how food is such a galvanizing universal force. And I don't think he did. I think these people might have passed.
There are recipes from sweet cucumber pickles to Slap It on the Thighs Butter Bar. That was from the Racing Wives Auxiliary Cookbook. And a new one for many of us, Burgoo.
There were about 8 calls that told us we had to make it to Kentucky. We had to make it there in the summertime. And we had to go there because starting at midnight, all-night groups of men from different parishes in the parish picnic tradition would start grilling meat. We say, what is it about men and meat and midnight and a pit? These guys just sit there and grill mutton, Boston butt, and chicken all night long, and then there's big groups of men with huge kettles, and it's sort of this frontier stew that's being made by the community, and this is how the schools and the churches support themselves, selling this takeaway stew, but it's so much more than stew. It is, they are really eating community.
They've got, you know, ladies in fancy hats sipping iced tea and old guys wearing really loud jackets who are talking, and the governor's always on hand greeting people and working the crowd. And they begin cooking in huge pots the night before, and they know when they're going to have a particularly good batch of burgoo when the cooking crew hears a plop in the middle of the night. And legend has it that there's a nest of black snakes in the trees above the kettles, and from time to time one of the snakes will climb out onto a limb to get a whiff of the stew and actually fall in.
Burgoo, as they say, burgoo will scorch in a heartbeat if you don't stir it, and it's the fellowship of stirring for 9 hours straight. It's
that like just a- reminds me that one of the things I loved looking through the book and listening to these stories is that, you know, we thought we were a fast food nation, and in many ways we are, but hidden in all these corners are these, you know, elaborate rituals.
It's really true. We were traveling during the last presidential campaign quite a bit, and everybody was in the newspapers and radio and everywhere was just dividing everybody up red and blue, and we were just hearing a kind of a different story. I mean, people are in a lot of ways trying to maintain traditions, trying to get to know their neighbor, and a lot of this happens through food because food is this common language. It's a real way in a lot of ways, between people. And we heard story after story of this happening in small rural towns, big cities, all across the nation.
You know, some people run for office and, you know, for elected office. Other people elect themselves to affect their community. And so many people are doing it just by getting a barbecue pit and roasting a lot of meat or doing a fish fry or a pancake breakfast and keeping their fire departments open or their libraries or the vet's hall. There is a lot of possibility. There's a lot of power in those pancakes.
That's Davia Nelson along with Nikki Silva. They are the Kitchen Sisters, authors of Hidden Kitchens, Stories, Recipes, and More from NPR's The Kitchen Sisters. There's also a CD sold separately. I want to thank you both for talking to us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks, Robin.
And for more, go to our website, here-now.org. We leave you with Tony Jo White singing about, what else, food. Here's Poke Salad Annie.
Some of y'all never been down south too much. I'm going to tell you a little bit about this so that you understand what I'm talking about. Down there we have a plant that grows out in the woods and the fields. Looks something like a turnip green. Everybody calls it poke salad. Poke salad.
Here and Now, a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again here and now.
Get home and cook it for supper. Because that's about all they had to eat. They did all right. I'm down in Louisiana, where the alligators grow so mean. That little dog girl that I swear to the world.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. As lawmakers return to Washington, how many will take up the appeasement debate? Also, Stupid Pet Tricks creator Meryl Marco, her new novel, is from a dog's point of view. Food. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, Here and Now.